Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
We're back with Evening Under Lamplight here on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. You are invited to attend with us as we continue our descent further into Dante's Inferno. We come now to the third circle of hell and see what Dante calls nuovi tormenti e nuovi tormentati, new forms of torment, new tormented souls. We're still in the region of the incontinent, those who have not deliberately chosen to do evil, but have overdone the good things of this world. Last time we saw the lustful, those who luxuriated in their sexual passions in directions that were not right. Now we come to the circle of the gluttons, specifically those who overindulged in eating and drinking, but there's a lot more to this. We might say that while the lustful went too far in their desires for another person, these gluttons have gone too far in their desires for material things. Not just food, but also, as we'll discuss, drugs, clothes, and all sorts of other self-indulgent items. We also get in this canto our first real taste of the political arguments that weave through the whole Divine Comedy. Dante's comments on the divided society of his native Florence might just bear some relevance to our world, where the current political divisions are pointing out just how fierce are the opposing parties in Britain, in America, in most places in our world at the moment, in fact. But before we move on to Dante, I want to tell you a story from Greek myth, the story of Erisichthon. By the way, I told this story in an experimental video taken beside our own fireplace a year and a half ago, but the sound went bad for a bit of it, and the lighting gave me deep shadows on my eyes and the appearance of missing a few teeth. But nevertheless, it's there on YouTube under Moments Under Lamplight if you want to see it. Or just keep listening to hear a better retelling of the tale. But before the story even begins, we can perceive its main theme just from the protagonist's name, Erisichthon, combining Eris, strife, and Chthon, the earth. In other words, here is a story about earth strife, a conflict between a man and the earth that ought to be nurturing him. Attend now to the story of Erisichthon, a story of gluttony and hunger. Once upon a time, there lived a rich, powerful man named Erisichthon. His life was centered upon his feasting, great, sumptuous banquets. He had just built a new banqueting hall, and all he needed now was a suitably magnificent banqueting table. As he roamed around the land, he one day spotted just the tree he needed for this table. It was a gigantic oak tree, centuries old, 50 feet across its trunk, and as high above the other trees in the grove as these other trees were above the grass on the ground. That's pretty high. This tree was sacred to Demeter, the goddess of the earth, and thus the goddess of harvest, and all that harvest brings. The goddess of abundance, the Mother Earth goddess, nourishing us all. Erisichthon knew that this was a sacred tree. Everyone knew it. And there were votive ribbons hanging from the boughs of the tree. But Erisichthon felt that he was entitled to take whatever he wanted, and he ordered his men to pick up their axes and start cutting down the tree. The first man hesitated. "This is a sacred tree," he said. "We can't just cut it down. It's dedicated to the goddess and not meant for us to take for our own uses." "Oh, really?" said Erisichthon. "Here, let me see that axe in your hand for a minute." And when the man gave Erisichthon the axe, Erisichthon lifted it, swung, and lopped that man's head off in one clean swoop. Then he himself approached the tree and cried out, "Be this the tree the goddess loves? Be this the goddess' very self? Its leafy crown shall touch the ground today." The tree itself groaned and shuddered, and then Erisichthon struck the trunk of the tree hard. And what do you suppose happened? Blood started spurting from the wound in the tree's side. Not daunted, Erisichthon continued to chop at the tree until suddenly a voice began to emerge from deep within the tree. "I am the nymph of this tree," the voice said. "I am Demeter's favorite nymph, as this is her favorite tree. In killing this tree, you are also killing me. But before I die, I curse you and declare that a dire punishment will befall you in retribution for this desecration you've just committed." This kind of talk didn't faze someone like Erisichthon, who kept on attacking the tree and then ordered his men to attach ropes to the high branches and pull the tree down. And down it came, crashing with its huge weight through that whole grove of lesser trees.
Man thinks, 'cause he rules the earth, he can do with it as he please. And if things don't change soon, he will. For man has invented his doom. First step was touching the moon. Now there's a woman on my block. She'll just sit there as the night grows still. She'll say, "Who gonna take away his license to kill?" Now they take him and they teach him and they groom him for life. Then they set him on a path where he's bound to get ill. Then they bury him with stars, sell his body like they do used cars. Now there's a woman on my block. She'll just sit there facing the hill. She'll say, "Who gonna take away his license to kill?" Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged with great skill. Now all he believes are his eyes, and his eyes, they just tell him lies. But there's a woman on my block, sitting there in a cold chill. She said, "Who gonna take away his license to kill?"
That was Bob Dylan's License to Kill, covering a wider scope than our story about Erisichthon is covering. But I think expressing the same spirit of lamentation at human greed has led Arisigthon to desecrate Demeter's sacred oak tree. Well, not just that tree, but the whole grove was now ruined after that almighty crash. And all the nymphs of the grove, mourning for their dead sister, made their way to Demeter herself, pleading with her to punish Arisigthon. "Don't worry," she told them. "I already have it all sorted out. Arisigthon, who had no thought for me and mine, will now have to live without me and all my good things of this earth. But with a twist. I curse him with never-ending hunger. We must send a message to the goddess of hunger to come impose this curse upon the man. But since I am the goddess of abundance, it would be a contradiction in terms for me to be anywhere near hunger. So please will one of you go on this errand out to the remotest part of the freezing wilderness where the goddess of hunger can be found. But let me stop here for a second and let Ted Hughes take over. This part of the story, a part that Ovid seems to have made up himself for his version of the tale in his Metamorphoses. This part of the tale is so vividly macabre, especially in Ted Hughes' lively translation, that we really must hear it, and in the translator's own macabre voice. So attend to Ted Hughes, reading his own translation of Ovid's account of the goddess Hunger. We come in as Demeter, or Ceres in this version, is giving her instructions. Don't miss the amazing description of the skeletal vision of hunger, her skin so glossy and so thin you could see the internal organs through it, scraping for whatever bits of food she can find, and attends to the kind of anti-rape. As she climbs into bed with Arisigthon and gives him a kiss, but no loving kiss.
Hear what I say and do not be afraid. Far away to the north of Scythia lies a barren country, leafless, dreadful, ice permanent as iron, air that aches. A howling land of rocks, gales, and snow. There mad hunger staggers. Go, bid hunger take possession of Arisigthon's belly. Tell her she has power over all my powers to nourish Arisigthon. Let all I pour or push down this fool's gullet only deepen his emptiness. Go. My dragon-drawn chariot will make the terrific journey seem slight. The nymph climbed away, and her first halt was the top of Caucasus. She soon found hunger, raking with her nails to bear the root of a tiny rockwort, till her teeth could catch and tear it. In shape and color, her face was a skull, bluish, her lips a stretched hole of frayed leather over bleeding teeth, her skin so glossy and so thin you could see the internal organs through it. Her pelvic bone was like a bare bone. The stump wings of her hip bones splayed open. As she bowed, her ribcage swung from her backbone in a varnish of tissue. Her ankle joints and her knee joints were huge bulbs, ponderous, grotesque on her spindly shanks. The Oread knew danger when she saw it. She proclaimed the command of the goddess from a safe distance. The whole speech only took a minute or so, yet a swoon of hunger left her trembling. She got away fast. All the way back to Thessaly, she gave the dragons their head. Now hear me. Though hunger lives only in opposition to Ceres, yet she obeys her. She soars through darkness across the earth to the house of Arisigthon. and bends above the pillow, where his face snores with open mouth. Her skeletal embrace goes around him. Her shrunk mouth clamps over his mouth, and she breathes into every channel of his body a hurricane of starvation. The job done, she vanishes. She hurtles away out of the lands of plenty, as if sucked back into the vacuum, deprivation's hollow territories that belong to her and that she belongs to. Erisythen snores on, but in spite of the god of sleep's efforts to comfort him, he dreams he sits at a banquet where the food tastes of nothing, a nightmare. He grinds his molars on air with a dry creaking, dreaming that he grinds between his molars a feast of nothing, food that is like air. At last he writhes awake in twisting, knotted cramps of hunger. His jaws seem to have their own life, snapping at air with uncontrollable eagerness to be biting into food and swallowing, like a cat staring at a bird out of reach. His stomach feels like a fist, gripping and wringing out the mere idea of food. He calls for food. Everything edible out of the sea and earth. When it comes, dearth is all he sees, where tables bend under the spilling plenty. Emptying bowls of heaped food, all he craves for is bigger bowls, heaped higher. Food for a whole city cannot sate him. Food for a whole nation leaves him faint with hunger.
Phew. And there is Erisichthon's punishment. Food for a whole nation leaves him faint with hunger. But it's not quite the end of the story. Erisichthon ate and ate, never satisfied, until he ran out of money, friends, and all resources. Wait, not all resources. He had a daughter who stayed by his side. The story does not explain what motivated her to stick by her father. Sitting there starving, Erisichthon's eyes lit up. He knew what to do. He went to the market and sold his daughter as a slave in order to get that much more money to buy more food. But his daughter, Mistra, was not helpless. She had, it appears, earlier on, been the lover of Poseidon, the god of the sea. And as she stood there on the brink of slavery, standing by the seacoast, she prayed to Poseidon, in the name of whatever desire he once had for her, to help her out of this predicament. Now, one of the attributes of the sea gods is the ability to change shape. This makes sense, since all water is a shape-shifter. Water has no shape. It just adapts itself to whatever container it finds itself in. So now Mistra was blessed with the ability to change her shape too. And she changed her shape into that of an old fisherman. And the man who had just purchased her and was bringing her home suddenly looked around and his slave was gone. Where was she? He saw an old fisherman nearby and asked if he'd seen a young woman who'd just been here with him. And the fisherman replied, in truth, I have seen no one else on this road here but myself. So what could the man do but return home without his slave girl, mystified? And Mistra, feeling empowered, returned home. Where else was she to go? When he discovered what had happened, Erisichthon was overjoyed. And each day he took his daughter to the marketplace and sold her in slavery, and each day she transformed into something else. A little boy, a cow, a fence, whatever. And so Erisichthon was able to feed his hunger for a while more. But finally, none of this would avail him. And one day, in desperation, he began to gnaw on himself. And finally, bite by bite, he ended up eating himself. Don't know how long it took to find the right music to follow the climax of Very Sick Thon consuming himself, but in the end, I think Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre gives us the right feel. It's both eerie and a little comical, but we could only listen to a little bit of it tonight. Okay, so much for this Very Sick Thon. But what does this myth tell us? It seems to have obvious connections to our environmental concerns. The rich, empowered man just grabs whatever he wants from the natural world for his own extravagant pleasures. But in the end, he just craves more and more and can never be satisfied until he consumes his very self. Our cravings for more fuel so we can drive to shopping malls paved over acres of once fruitful farmland. Our demands for exotic foods transported across the globe. Our control of the water supplies for our own short-term uses with no thought to long-term consequences. All these, as we know, but as some people refuse to admit, all these are ruining the world and may well destroy our life, as Very Sick Thon destroyed his life. But if that's all there was to Very Sick Thon's story, we would have done better to tell the story later on in the Inferno, at the circle of those who are violent against God's world. But here let me draw our attention to two other aspects of the story. First of all, there's the profaning of something sacred. In the Greek myths, this usually takes the form of some mortal disrespecting the deities or even denying their very existence. And the deities usually represent certain aspects of nature that we ought to treat with respect. And if we make use of these things, we should use them responsibly, with gratitude. Denying the sacredness, then, leads to a punishment from the gods, which in the myths becomes a symbol for the misuse of the sacred things. The Propertides, for example, denied the divinity of Aphrodite. This can be interpreted as meaning that they denied the sacredness of sex. Therefore, they just used sex for their own ends. And what happened to them in the myth? The goddess, angry at their disrespect, turned them into prostitutes. That is, people who use sex only for their own ends as a way to make money, ignoring the pleasure and the deep emotional bonding that responsible and grateful sexuality offers. The divine gift of the goddess. And what happens to Erisichthon's disrespect for Demeter? He uses her sacred tree instead of, as any less selfish person would do, instead of standing in awe at its beautiful majesty, towering above all the other trees, a symbol of nature's abundance. And as a result of just using the tree for selfish ends, he was denied the use of this abundance. The abundance of food he ordered to be set before him did him no good at all. But one thing more to consider. Symbolically, our bodies can stand for our identity. If, for instance, King Lear strips off all his clothes and exposes his naked, unaccommodated body to the tempest, this can be taken as a sign that he's letting go of all the superficial parts of himself and facing the world with his true self, his deepest identity. But now look. Here's Aresigthon eating his body. Does this mean he's consuming his own identity? Is that what unchecked greed and gluttony bring us to in the end? The destruction of our very identities? Well, maybe. Stick around and see how the gluttons in Dante's third circle have lost all their identity. Let's move on to our meeting with Dante. Okay, here we are in Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. And I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson with Evening Under Lamplight, of course. Let's get back to our meeting with Dante. At the end of Canto 5, you recall, Dante had fainted, falling as a dead man falls, overwhelmed by his encounter with Paolo and Francesca and the whole circle of the lustful. He comes back to his right mind at the start of Canto 6, and instead of the whirling lovers, tossed round and round by that bufera infernal, that hellish storm, he finds himself now in a place where no one is going anywhere. Like the sodden gormandizers, stuffed silly after a big meal, unable to move around, here are the gluttons, all stretched out on the ground, and as usual, the scene Dante paints for us tells us what we need to know about the specific sin or specific state of the soul being dealt with here. So what is this place like? It is a place of endless cold rain, churning up a stinking blanket of mud as it falls, eterna, maledetta, fredda, e greve, never-ending, cursed, freezing, heavy. Well, not just rain, but, Dante says, more like thick hail and dirty water mixed with snow. And there are the forms of the gluttons, spread out naked under this downpour, submerged in the mud. All the while, they keep squirming, trying to find some relief, turning over and over. Another kind of circular movement, but now just twirling and getting nowhere, just a different kind of uncomfortableness. Dante gives us a picture we all have experienced, sort of. It's the kind of day we might call hellish, but Dante's vision of hell goes much further. Just try to picture one of those cold, rain-filled Saturday afternoons in November. But you're not inside watching television with a drink by the fireside. You're outside, lying naked and unprotected in the stinking mud produced by this cursed freezing rain or sleet, more like a muddy slush sticking to your skin. And that would be bad enough, but there's another element in the third circle that makes things much worse. There's the presence of Cerberus. Cerberus is another functionary of hell taken from classical mythology. In Virgil's Aeneid, he is a three-headed dog guarding the underworld who is given a special cake to distract him so Aeneas can get past him and proceed on his destined journey through death. Here in the Inferno, however, it's not clear whether Cerberus is a dog or whether he is only dog-like, barking, as Dante says, caninamente, like a dog. Is he a barking dog? Or some sort of perversion of a human figure, with three heads, by the way, who just acts like a dog, ravenously devouring his food and barking and snapping at everyone. Listen to how Dante describes him. His eyes are red, his beard a greasy black, his belly swollen. With his taloned hands, he claws the spirits, flays and quarters them. And he's not the only dog-like figure here. The sinners in their misery also howl come cani, like dogs. We are meant, of course, to connect gluttony with the way dogs just gobble down whatever food is put there before them. Well, most dogs do, not mine. But that's another attribute of gluttony, fastidiousness, that we'll consider in a few minutes. Or is Cerberus something else? At another point, Dante calls him a vermo, literally a worm, a vermin. But this is worm in the sense of a snake or a serpent, or even, which might be more appropriate here, a dragon. Instead of the cake given to Cerberus in the Aeneid, here Virgil just picks up some mud and flings it at Cerberus, who greedily gobbles it up. This emblem of gluttony will eat anything. Dorothy Sayers tells us that Cerberus is the image of uncontrolled appetite. And the gluttons, whose appetite preyed upon people and things, are seen now as what they really are, the helpless prey on which that appetite gluts itself. Cerberus, in a frenzy, is constantly barking, creating a loud, jarring noise, well, I think like what stunned the new prisoners arriving at Auschwitz to the blare of shouts and commands. And like those prisoners constantly being beaten, so the sinners here are constantly being mauled by Cerberus, his sharp claws ripping off their skin. Dante's appalled by what he sees here. There may be worse pains, he says, but none more disgusting. The noise, the drenching, and most of all that putrid mud. Think of the trenches on the Western Front. Yes, it's overpowering to be thrown into such a place. But Dante the writer is showing us that Dante the pilgrim is a little naive at this stage. If he thinks that this is the most disgusting thing, it's only because he's not yet seen what's going on further down in the pit of hell.
Thank you.
That was Paganini's Third Caprice, played by Itzhak Perlman. And now it's time for us to look further into this image of gluttony. What does it tell us about the state of our soul when we give in to our appetite for more and more? Remember, first of all, that sex and food are nourishing and good for us and delightful if enjoyed properly, with gratefulness and community. But these people in the area of incontinence, the lustful last time, the gluttons this time, they overdid it or used it for self-centered ends. Like Arisigthon, they used things without respect, without gratitude. Their motto is, more for me, more for me, more for me. Like these shades who keep squirming round and round but getting nowhere, gluttons keep moving from one new thing to the next without getting anywhere. While still eating their main course, their minds are moving to the dessert, and at the dessert they are looking ahead to the next meal. They get nowhere. The same old cravings follow them all day long. The same goes for the person who sees a new pair of shoes in the shop window and must buy them and does buy them, indulging that old consumerist squirm, feeding their hunger for new things, but again, like Arisigthon, never satisfied. They feel the same desire when going past the next window of shoes. Just as lust in Dante is not great sexual passion, but the more puny passive surrender to the passion, so here gluttony involves no scenes of sumptuous eating, but the underside of those obsessive feasts. Here's Dorothy Sayers again. The surrender to sin, which began with mutual indulgence, leads by an imperceptible degradation to solitary self-indulgence. Of this kind of sin, the gluttons are chosen as the image. Here is no reciprocity and no communication. Each soul grovels along in the mud without heeding his neighbors, a sightless company, Dante calls them. Let me add that just as we saw Paolo and Francesca hanging out together, even though there was no longer any relationship between them, so here the souls are not entirely solitary. As one of them turns over to the other side, the next guy over nudges himself a little closer, using this first one as a kind of shield against the rain, the merest shred of community. And Dorothy Sayers reminds us that gluttony is only the specific image for self-indulgence of many other kinds. I think we can see this self-indulgence going in two different directions, each destructive of community. They put their pleasure of whatever sort, drugs, food, watching their favorite television program, ahead of relationships. Here we see the person making a fuss at the restaurant, endlessly questioning the waiter about each item on the menu and whether it has low sodium, whether it's dairy-free, whether it contains traces of this or that. All right, there's such a thing as caution about food that will damage us, but this is a social occasion and you're being a drag. Or the whole array of options for coffee at a Starbucks, ensuring that placing an order will take three times as long as it needs to, holding up the queue for everyone else. I've always liked the example of gluttony in the film Private Benjamin, where we find Mr. Benjamin at his daughter's huge wedding party, not joining in the celebrations, but off in a side room watching, of all things, the Phillies game. Maybe I like it because that's probably where you'd have found me too, watching the Philadelphia Phillies. Well, here's another example. In one of Somerset Maugham's stories about Ashenden, a British spy during the First World War, we find Ashenden in Russia, preparing to run off with his Russian lover. They go off first for a trial week together to see if they really enjoy being with each other. Every morning at the hotel, they are offered a different kind of eggs for breakfast. But his Russian lover insists each day that she must have scrambled eggs. Ashenden then leaves her, on the excuse, he tells us, that she has shown unpardonable crass disregard for a servant, in this case for the cook, who, she insists, must make this special meal for her. A gentleman or a lady puts community first and eats what is presented. A fastidious glutton insists on having it his or her own way.
Well, you can't read out your Bible. You can't fall down on your knees and pray to the Lord. But I'm mama, but it ain't gonna do no good. You're gonna need my help someday. Well, if you can't quit your sinning, please quit your low-down way. If you can't run down to the desert, you can't stick your head in the sand, you can raise up your right hand, but your good man ain't a coming home. You better understand, you're gonna need my help someday, gonna need my help.
Well, that's sort of appropriate. Early Bob Dylan this time. Quit your low-down ways. If you can't quit your sinning, please quit your low-down ways. Don't be a damned fastidious glutton. Another aspect of gluttony is addiction. Arisigthon is an image of that, too. Needing more and more fixes until he does away with himself forever. As we've said before, Dante is offering us not so much a catalogue of actual damned sinners in the afterworld as poetic images of states of the human soul. We all have experienced addiction in one way or another and have found ourselves in a state that resonates with Dante's image. No hope of ever escaping the never-ending freezing rain beating down, the endless barking in our ears, and the inescapable clawing from Cerberus, and finding ourselves stuck squirming in the stinking mud. Richard Rohr reminds us of the addictive patterns of thinking, stories our ego tells us to explain what's going on, always seeing events and people through our own point of view only, illusory stories for the most part, losing the good of the intellect, rehearsing for ourselves the private image we have of ourselves and the image we want to present to others. These stories become so habitual we don't even notice them, but they work like an addiction, demanding more and more. Hey, I wrote her that email 3 hours ago and she hasn't replied. She must hate me, but I didn't do anything wrong. She's a bitch. And then the next communication that does come from her reinforces your story as you interpret what she says to confirm your view of her as a bitch. On and on. I think these kinds of stories, usually completely ungrounded, rain down on us so fast we don't even notice them, but they are there, the stinking mud sticking to us in our discomfort. The way out of this addiction is to catch our thinking patterns early, and by bringing them up to our conscious awareness, we can, over time, let them go and free ourselves. Dante's image of what it feels like to suffer these addictions is one very useful way to bring these patterns of thought up into our awareness. Another problem about addiction is that we expend all our energy, and like Arisigthon, all our resources, in feeding the addiction instead of in doing something more productive for others. We keep taking, never giving. In this way, gluttony is allied to greed, which also features in this canto. That greedy desire to have the food we want, even if we can't use it. We stockpile it so we don't run out someday in the future. Or we show up at a buffet dinner and overload our plate because, well, it's free and we can't turn it down, even if we know it's going to make us sick later on. We see the opposite of this kind of greed in the episode where the Israelites were fed with manna in the desert. Good, wholesome, but not especially gourmet food coming down to them from heaven. Nourishment, not the cursed rainfall here in hell. But the Israelites were not allowed to stockpile the manna. If they did, they found that the food was ruined the next day. It bred worms and stank. The antidote to gluttony and greed, it seems, is to live in the moment, mindful of and grateful for what is there before us right now. Schubert's Moment Musicale No. 3, played by Richard Steiner. One thing more before we move on. As Dante and Virgil make their way across this circle, they have to step on all these people who are strewn all over the place, but their feet go right through the figures. They seem to be real people with bodies, but actually the bodies are empty. And so the first time that Dante comes into actual contact with any of these shades in hell, it turns out not to be a real contact at all. But what might these macabre, empty forms of bodies show us about the state of the soul given over to gluttony? Maybe these souls were empty inside all the time. They sought all these material things, food, alcohol, drugs, shoes, baseball cards, in the delusion that having these things would fill that inner void. But all they end up doing is increasing that inner void and leaving themselves even more dissatisfied. But as Virgil and Dante walk along, one of these souls suddenly sits up as they go past. "Hey," he says, "can you remember me?" No, sorry," says Dante. You're soaking wet and covered in mud. I can't tell who you are." Well, it turns out that this is a fellow Florentine, someone who had been around when Dante was young, and he was nicknamed Chaco, a name that means pig or hog, or perhaps better, something like Porky or even Mr. Piggy. And notice that he is unrecognizable. Like Arisicthon eating his own body and thus destroying his own identity, so Chaco has lost his. Gluttony, it is clear, takes away your identity. Perhaps you identify yourself only with the food you eat or the possessions you buy. Not only does Dante not recognize him, but historians don't either. There are a few guesses about his identity, but only guesses. We think that probably Chaco was some kind of life of the party, monopolizing the dinner conversation, and in this way, destroying the communal atmosphere. And Chaco asks Dante, when he, Dante, returns to the upper world, to remind our friends of me. He still, it appears, retains some memory of friendships, our friends, as though he and Dante are pals. But what kind of pal is a shadow figure? And anyway, how can Dante remind the people back home when this fellow can't even be identified except through a nickname? Chaco is the first of many Florentines that Dante the Pilgrim will meet in his journey through hell up to paradise. And this gives Dante the poet the chance to lash out at his city, which he loves, but which he bitterly criticizes for its many faults. The pilgrim asks Chaco if he can tell him anything about the citizens of this city, a città partita, a divided city. And now we get into Italian politics, or rather, won't really get into them just now. We'll briefly mention that at this time there were two bitter political parties in Florence, the White Guelphs and the Black Guelphs. Dante was a member of the White Guelphs, but in 1302, thanks to help from the Pope, whom Dante reviles for his corruption, the Blacks gained control of the city and drove out the Whites and ordered Dante into exile. Dante is writing this poem several years after he was exiled, but the poem is set in the year 1300, that is, before his exile. So Dante the poet can predict what will happen in Dante the pilgrim's future, but in Dante the poet's past. Get it? As we discover, the dead in hell can see some way into the future and also into the past. What they cannot see is the present moment in the living world. And Chaco here predicts the defeat of Dante's party and indirectly predicts Dante's exile. We'll see this topic raised several more times before we're finished. We might want to ask why Dante felt the Circle of Gluttony was the appropriate place to start talking about Florentine politics. Perhaps it's because both the gluttons and the leaders of the factions are motivated by appetite. Politicians, we might say, are gluttons for power, or even addicts. Once they have a bit of power, they keep needing to feed themselves more and more with further power. And like gluttons, they use things, whatever it takes, in order to keep the other side down and remain in place. The oppressive Black Guelphs are merely another form of that awful rain, or like Cerberus, clawing at the soul. And all this in the city Dante loved. This deeply divided community, divided through gluttony, greed, and envy. Well, we're living through similar things ourselves these days, aren't we? There's one more feature of this encounter with Chaco we ought to notice. Chaco speaks to Dante and then stops. He ended his words. But then he has more words a minute later as he tells Dante about the strife about to take place in Florence. And then he comes to an end of his distressing words. Dante asks him about the fate of some prominent Florentine figures of the previous generation, and Chaco has more words to say and then announces that he'll say no more, he'll answer no more questions. Why does Dante the poet describe Chaco like this? Now, this is a long shot, take it or leave it, but it sounds like a gluttonous addict. I'm not going to have another helping of ice cream. I'm not going to play another game of solitaire. That's it, I'm through with dope, never again. And then the next thing you know, there they are again, caught in this mechanical repetition, having more ice cream, playing another dozen games of solitaire. Back on the street for more dope. But the repetition doesn't go on forever. At some point, they just stop functioning, as happens here to Chaco, who suddenly collapses. He just turns off, almost mechanically, as though winding down. First, his eyes go into a blank stare, then his head droops down as though his neck has lost its rigidity. Then the body just keels forward into the mud. Forevermore. He's inert, just a suffering mass, until the last trump, when he will be given his body back at the second judgment, and then he'll really feel the pain of this sozza mistura dell'ombre e della pioggia, the foul mixture of these shades and the rain, their identity now mixed in with the world around them, which when alive they tried to consume. Now it's consumed them. And then the canto comes to an end with a cliffhanger. Just as Dante and Virgil get to the point where the path descends to the next level, they come across another of these hellish monsters, Pluto, il gran nemico, the great enemy. Who is Pluto? Why is he here? How does he threaten our hero? Well, come back next time as we enter Canto 7 and find out. And so, good night from Evening Under Lamplight, and specifically from me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, pleased to be coming to you from Cambridge 105. We're on Facebook and SoundCloud and at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk, and we're back on Cambridge 105 in a fortnight. Now let's go out with a bit of George Gershwin playing George Gershwin, with a song perhaps gluttons will understand. When you want 'em, you can't get 'em. When you've got 'em, you don't want 'em.